Welcome. You're about to be ushered past the velvet rope and into a world of hyper-effective salesmanship that's understood and used only by the world's most notoriously rich and successful marketers. We're taking a journey deep inside the human brain, past the surface clutter, and into the psychological insights to answer the one crucial question: what makes people buy? I'm your host, Kevin Rogers, along with the most ripped off and respected copywriter alive, John Carlton. And this is Psych Insights for Modern Marketers. Hi, welcome to Psych Insights. It's Kevin Rogers. John Carlton will join us in just a second. Today we're exploring what John numbered Psych Insight number one. Let me read it to you. Civilians have the luxury of adopting any wacky worldview they like, but marketers must face reality. Your human prospects have one foot still in the jungle, or rather, the ancient part of our brain is still there. We're talking dark needs, reptilian instincts, and basic greed-fear responses that lie just under the thin veneer of the neocortex modern slab. This is not a cynical nor a negative view. It's just fundamental step one knowledge for anyone needing to understand how to communicate at the levels required to influence, persuade, and perform complex capitalistic functions. In other words, to exchange moolah for goods. I love that ending. So, John, welcome, and I'm happy to explore this with you today. Fascinating.
Hey, Kevin. Yeah, this is, I call this Psych Insight number one. As you well know, I think the first Psych Insight I put up on Facebook was number 567 or something. I kind of started in the middle. I haven't been good about numbering these in a logical way, being a right brain type of creative guy that I am. But this really is number one. This earns number one in any kind of exploration of I hate to call it academic, but we will use a little bit of academic stuff looking into this. But how the brain works, most humans have zero clue how the brain works at all. It's just we have a vague notion that we have this thing cooking inside our skulls. It's pretty important, and we don't want to like drill into it or anything, and we want to avoid being crushed by pianos and stuff. But we still, if we grew up with the Three Stooges or even a lot of modern stuff, you know, Rocky Balboa took what sledgehammer hits. You know how they got the sound in Rocky of the boxers hitting each other? They went in and took a slab of beef and hit it with a sledgehammer and recorded it.
Wow.
So when he's hitting Apollo or whoever it is, that's a sledgehammer hitting a side of beef. And those hits in reality would have knocked him out, but it was being in movies. So a lot of people get the wrong idea about how much damage the brain can take, what the brain actually does. And actually, I remember a girl in high school who refused to visualize any of the goo inside of us. She didn't like thinking of us as pumping blood or having hearts or brains, or, you know, we're essentially bags of gas and fluid. And it's amazing how tough this skin is. The major organ of the human body is the skin, and it's holding all this stuff together, right, along with our muscles and nerves and stuff.
And the fact that we can take chunks of it out, work on it, stick it back in you, have it keep
unbelievable.
Going.
And, you know, they find examples of brain surgery going all the way back to prehistoric times. It's pretty amazing. They were drilling holes in guys' heads to take out demons, probably. But they did it, and the people lived because those holes were old and had healed. And anyway, but this woman reminded me of what a lot of people think about the human form. They see only what they see in the mirror or what they see in photos, and that's what they – so they have this idea of the human. But really, we're a complex machine of – you know, with chemical and mechanical reactions and all these things going on. The thing that scares a lot of people is that they think that takes away our humanity. If we break it down to machinery and complex mechanical functions and chemical dumps and stuff, it takes away somehow our soul or something. Well, I like to tell people I'm not a religious guy, but I am a spiritual guy. I do believe there are connections with the universe. It just doesn't jive with any of the religions out there. Mm-hmm. although I picked up a few things from Zen here and there. But basically, for me, learning how the human brain works, why people buy, why they're afraid of certain things, why they do things, the reality of the way humans interact in the world in this modern concrete jungle that we've created to mimic the old natural organic jungle that we came out of. It makes me love humans more, not less. It doesn't scare me that we are, soulless machines wandering around, in an unpredictable environment. It's more that just being real takes away the nonsense of not being able to understand why people do what they do. And for me, it makes humans more lovable. It makes the experience of being alive more valuable. It just amps everything up. So for people who are afraid of looking into this stuff, I can tell you that, at least from my empirical experiments and looking into what really drives humans, it's actually made for a better relationship with my fellow humans rather than a worse one. I haven't turned into a sociopath, serial killer. Instead, I care very much about people, and since I'm able to help them more because I can understand more deeply what's going on, and I'm not just taking things on the surface, not playing in the shallow part of the pool, so to speak, but swimming out where it's deep. And it's much more complex and it's more dangerous, but it's more interesting and it's also more effective. When you're trying to sell something to somebody, you're not just dealing with what he needs right now, what she has needed or whatever problem she's having. There's a whole bunch of stuff going on there. So just as a simple insight into the psychology of humans, looking at how the brain functions goes an enormously long way, especially if you're trying to write copy, you're trying to create a sales funnel in your marketing to bring people in. Just understanding this will remove a lot of the frustrations you have, because as we know, a lot of great products are in the marketing graveyard because nobody figured out how to sell them. So, and a lot of really shitty products are out there scoring big because they had great marketing. And why is that? It's because the human brain doesn't know how to value things on a quality level. It knows what it wants, and if it believes that this thing is going to do what it wants, then that's where you get the pet rock from the 70s. People bought rocks in boxes for a couple of bucks. You remember that, don't you?
Yeah, absolutely. And then, of course, who knows how many knockoffs there were, because everybody goes, "Why did I think of that?" And I go, "Because it's the reason you just said. Who would think of that? I mean, I wonder if the person who invented the pet rock had this sort of psych insight that we're discussing right now and went, it's the castaway effect. If you, everybody's lonely and everybody needs a Mr. Wilson to dress up and put a face on and talk to, John, when I think about ads, it's almost like there's two, to really break it down in its simplest nature, there's two ways kind of to go at people. A lot of people's instinct is to try to speak to people where they live in a way that sort of caters to their already thinking, to their language, to their,
join the conversation that you're going on in their head.
Yeah. But not disrupt things too much. Just sort of say, I totally get what you're after. This is the whole thing, sales without being salesy, and everybody seems to like now want to just like gently give everyone a pillow ride into their shopping cart. And you've always been the kind of writer who grabs people and shakes them and goes, look, face this. This is what you're really afraid of. This is what could happen if you don't take action. And like you always say, if you know you have a product of value, shame on you for not doing everything in your power to make sure you realize help people realize they need it, and because they can improve their life. So I don't know, to try to draw that line down the middle between, most car commercials or commercials on TV are just, think about like the new Wendy's campaigns. They got this girl who's kind of supposed to be Wendy, and just like, let's just, you know, have this polite lie going that this fruit is actually tasty and okay, and you can look like me when you eat it, as opposed to your stuff with, say, like TRS, and I think like the nickel letter, and going, look, you know, next time you are walking with your family to the car and some creep approaches, you know, so exactly.
Well, it has to arrive at the right time too. And I think the operative thing is to understand where humans are and what they're, you know, the two basic things that good salesmen understand about humans is greed and fear. And these are not bad words in a salesman's lexicon. Mm-hmm. Greed doesn't mean an unrational need to have all the cake and nobody else gets any cake at
purely
the party.
Selfish,
it's
right.
more of you want to make sure you get your slice is the biggest, and there's things. And the fear isn't necessarily the Hitchcockian thing of being scared out of your wits. It's understanding that people live in a constant sense of losing out, of the anxiety of not being hip, of not being invited to a party somewhere where everybody's having much more fun than they are now, of the fears that they're going to die lonely and forgotten, and the greed that they want recognition, they want some kind of respect, all this stuff. So it can all be brought down to fear and greed. Mm. But that comes from understanding how the human brain works. And that fear and greed stuff goes back to what we call the hindbrain, the reptilian brain. And then it also picks up with the limbic system. Well, I'll explain a little bit of this in a 2-minute update on brains in just a minute. But there's the reptile. That's part of the brain that we have in common with actual lizards and stuff. It controls the basic things that we're not conscious about, breathing, eye movement, making sure the body sweats and things like that. And then there's the limbic system, which kind of makes us kind of human, which is the emotional center of the brain. It creates memories, attaches emotions to them, and it makes us care about things, and it makes us other than just a lizard might go. Might not even acknowledge it's hungry. It just might have this overwhelming need that it doesn't even have consciousness. So it is more like a machine in a way. And it sees a fly and it goes after the fly and it zaps the fly and it eats. And then it doesn't have that need anymore. It goes on to need sun because it's cold, and then needs to sleep because it's tired, things like that. The limbic system then starts making us human, in that we have memories. We start having emotions, like we care about something. We care about someone else. We start doing things that put ourselves in danger to save the person we love. We start feeling these things. And then the big one is the neocortex. That's the third part of the brain. That's the big slab over everything else that makes us human. That's where, and I read this on a site, I think it's a great way of saying it. The neocortex is about 2/3 of the human brain. It's the most recent part of the brain. And it's where higher level language, consciousness, imagination, and abstract thought comes from. The chimp, we doubt that chimpanzees, for example, can have future thoughts. Maybe they do. If they do, it's at a very low level because their cerebral cortex is not evolved that much. So we can actually think, what's going to happen to me 50 years from now? We can think, if I do this, then tomorrow Susie's going to be mad at me and my marriage may fall apart. And we can do all of these complex things. Imagination, writing novels, creating whole new science fiction worlds, creating movies, watching a movie, and being conscious, you know, waking up and understanding I am separate from these other people around me, and I have my own thing going on, and I'm not part of an anthill. There's a lot of things going on. So it starts to get complex, and that's where humans kind of screw up. So basically, this insight, this psych insight number one, is that the reality is that I've heard some people say humans still have one foot in the jungle, which means that their ape brain, so to speak, is still back in that me want, me take, you know, you got more than me kill you, that kind of just living in the jungle, survival of the fittest thing. And then we have one foot in civilization, where it's somehow different than that. And I'm not buying that. Through my career as a salesman, and from what I've found dealing with humans, that ain't the case. It's more we're in a new jungle. We went out of the organic jungle with trees and plants and stuff, and created kind of a mock jungle full of concrete and skyscrapers, or even if you're in a small town, just buildings. Even if you're in a farm, you got a barn, you got
a cave dwelling. Yeah,
yeah. It's still a construct. It's something that wasn't there before, and the human built, the human made up, and for whatever reason, we've decided this is how we're going to live. We made our own caves rather than search for naturally occurring caves. So by understanding that, it starts to explain a lot of human behavior, such as rioting, love murders, people murdering their lovers, you know, and wonder why. I don't know. Just, you know, they pissed me off and I had to kill her, you know, because I loved her. And why people do what they do, and people do things that aren't always in their best interest. Everything from voting to making simple decisions during the day that aren't going to help them. They go and insult the boss because they just, quote, had enough. They're not really conscious of it, but they're conscious enough to form the sentences and get into the social interaction. It's going to get them fired. And then their future thinking takes over. They get all anxious and pretty soon they're on Xanax all the time because they're freaking out with panic attacks. And you start understanding how the irrational parts of the brain. When I say irrational, that means there's a part of your brain, that reptilian brain, doesn't say, if I do this, it'll be good. If I do this, it'll be bad. I better think. It's not doing that. It's like me see, me want, me hungry, me eat. And that's happening all the time. That's happening every second of the day that you're alive. Then it's combined with this emotional side, which is, I think a lot of people understand that emotions can be wacky. You can love something that you hated 5 minutes ago. You're not even sure how you feel about something, but the feeling part of it. And good salesmen know that a good sales process often involves getting interest with logic and rationality, but selling on emotion. That's by making it so emotionally uncomfortable for the prospect that they buy. They would rather buy than not buy. Remember, you're dealing with an inherently hostile situation. Even people who want that new shiny Plymouth, they need a car, they want the Plymouth, their whole heart's in the Plymouth. They're still not ready to buy because because the fear kicks in. The greed is, I want that car. I see myself in that car. I'm not going to be happy until I'm sitting in that shiny new Plymouth Stargazer. But the other side is, I don't want to get ripped off. I don't want my neighbor to hear what I paid for it, and somehow that's a bad deal. I don't know what the wife's going to say when I drive this thing home. I'm not sure if I can afford. All these other fears start coming in, so they got to balance that out. Often the final thing is just a what the fuck. Let's do it. And they sign the check, and pretty soon they got their new Plymouth Stargazer, and they're not quite sure how they got there. Then buyer's remorse kicks in, all this stuff. So the good salesman understands this process. There's a lot of – it's not like a schizophrenic with voices saying, you know, go kill the Pope in his head. It's more like a lot of different – imagine a control room, kind of like Star Trek. You know, there's a captain, a conscious captain, but he doesn't have total control because he hasn't got his finger on the button of the thrusters and all these things going on. And they're arguing all the time. And whatever one part of your brain wants, the other part is saying, "Nah, we really shouldn't do that, you know, because we'll go to jail if we you know, fulfill our lust for Susie Q in the office." You know, so there's these things going on all the time. And a lot of people look at this and they start to get an understanding of it, but then they throw their hands up in frustration. It's like, I don't know, you know. But as a salesman, we don't have. If you want to be a great salesman, if you want to get into the Hall of Fame as a salesman or as a copywriter or a marketer, you've got to understand this at a slightly deeper level. You got to swim out of the shallow part of the pond where you're just observing things, going, "Wow, isn't that interesting?" I thought people were buying my crap because they wanted, you know, X, and it turns out they really wanted Y. Isn't that odd? And rather than do that in the shallow part, you go to the deeper part and you go, why did they want Y when I thought it was X? Where is the disconnect coming? And should I just abandon even trying to sell this as Y and sell this as X and sell this Y instead? And by the way, just to touch up on what you said about getting people's attention and making ads startling, But ad, whether it's in a newspaper or on TV or online, or appears in an email, or just happens to flip up as a banner on a site somewhere, eventually, to make that thing work, it has to be the main event in your prospect's day. It has to be that thing where he goes, wow. And it's like he can even remember sometimes. I've had people tell me they remember when they got that first ad. Mm-hmm. And because that was a day when their life had been going like this, suddenly that stopped, that sealed off, that was now history, and now they were something different. And often people think, you know, I've written ads where I know people say, wow, I bought that product, I was so excited, it just changed my life. And I said, well, how did you like the product? They go, oh, I never watched it, never cracked the cell phone. They felt that they did what they needed to do by just buying the ad.
Right.
Or excuse me, by buying the product. The ad, in other words, they sat back after giving their credit card to the woman on the phone or clicking, you know, finishing, you know, done, sale. They sat back, wow, well, my life's going to change now. And that's as far as they go. And then the product arrives a couple days later, or maybe it arrives that night digitally or whatever,
yeah.
Or maybe even immediately. But they don't get to it right immediately because they're exhausted. They just made this huge emotional thing. That's, you have something to add to that?
It reminds me of a study I read about people's food choices. And very often people will get in line, say, at a fast food place. And they're staring up at the menu and there's two or three people ahead of them. And they've made a conscious decision at some point to eat healthier. So they're looking up there and they say, okay, I'm going to get the salad and that will make me feel good. And then they've made that decision and then they get distracted. They check their iPhone. They get up to the counter and the woman says, what can I get you? And they say, I'll take the number four, which is the double cheeseburger with the fries, right? And upsize that shit, you know. And so they say why that happens is because in our brain, we've already rewarded ourselves for having the salad merely by making the decision to have the salad. And now you can reward yourself mere seconds later by having the number four.
And that's part of the neocortex ability to have imagination and abstract thought. Abstract thought is having thoughts that an animal is just not going to have. It's both future thinking. It's thinking about what's it going to be like when Susie comes over and we're playing Monopoly and should I break out the good wine? And you imagine this thing, this future event, and you can break it out in all different things and change it and do things. That's abstract. Mm-hmm. And then you start thinking about, you know, where science and physics and stuff come from. You know, how do atoms interact and how did the universe start and things that we can't view, we can't see. There's no empirical knowledge. That is wonderful when it's used in the right way, but in everyday actions, the way people react, you can see how it would confuse the hell out of the lizard brain. We're hungry. I'm there because I'm hungry. I need, you know, basically anything you put in your stomach would solve that. And that's why, you know, when they catch coyotes and they do autopsies on coyotes just to see what they're eating, they'll find belt buckles and rocks and all kinds of stuff. You know, these are voracious creatures.
Right.
And it's like, what's your prime directive? And we don't have single prime directives. We have multiple directives through the day. If you're hungry, it's to get something in your stomach. Then there's a little tiny voice going, yeah, well, we want it to be nutritious. And then there's the part of your system that actually is monitoring chemical stuff and saying, we need protein. You know, there's no protein in the salad. So you got to, you know, we need this and that ain't cutting it. And there's some vision, but you don't understand it consciously. You're going through all this stuff. And mm-hmm. and it seems like a mess, but it's really something that we've been able to break down, especially in the last, I don't know, 20 years or so since after I graduated from college, they really started to understand the brain on a deeper level, really started to be able to pinpoint. And in the last few years, it's gotten really good when they're doing studies where they're sending in dyes and we can tell what part of the brain is lighting up.
Right.
And we'll find out how people with brain damage operate and how people that had to relearn to speak after a stroke are what's lighting up. And the brain is very, very it can change, it can do things, and there's no one set way. We think of the right brain as being creative, the left brain as being logical. Sometimes that'll change, and sometimes the left brain is destroyed, and then the right brain just picks it up and does stuff. It's hard, but they're able to do that. So it's very flexible in what it does, and it's also not necessarily predictable, but we're making huge strides. Mm. You don't need to be that deeply involved in the intellectual parts, but I would suggest if you go on, say, slate.com or one of the online magazines and they have an article on brain chemistry or something, read it, because that will be a layman's view of what the scientists are doing. If you read the scientific papers or Scientific American or anything like this, it's going to be more complex. You're going to get lost. But read the pop psychology stuff. There used to be a I don't know if the magazine's still out there. It was called Psychology Today, I think.
Yeah, I think it's still out there. Yeah.
And I used to get that a lot back in my early career because at that time in the 80s, it was doing a great job of bringing down high-end psychological insight into usable daily stuff. And they were doing it for the average layman. They were trying to explain why people behave the way they do. And isn't it interesting they're doing all these tests? For me, it was understanding the demographics better. I also got this magazine called American Demographics. I'm not sure if that's even out there. Hmm. That was aimed sometimes at marketers. That helped you see how – you know, why a majority chose this over this on different things and the actual demographics, which are essentially the acting out of the psychological stuff going on in people's heads. Why do people move from the city to the suburbs? You can invent reasons, you can pretend that you know, or you can actually find out. And often what people say they did is not the reason. You take what they say they did, you take how they answer questions when it's anonymous and when they're going to be held responsible for what they answer, and that those would be two different things. Mm. You can actually then delve in and go deeper. So the old thing there that Gallup polls used to talk about is what they would poll and ask how many people had read the Bible. And this goes back to the 60s and 50s, back when they were first getting polling data down into what they call a science. Mm-hmm. And they'd have 80% of the people would say they read the Bible. But then if they went deeper and started asking them questions, they find out that the number dropped dramatically, that people were socially thinking they should say they read the Bible. And in their head, they actually thought they had, but they hadn't. So that opened this whole thing of, well, why are they saying that?
Right.
And what implications are that just for vague psychological insights? As a salesman, you start to get that stuff and it starts to answer some questions. Why aren't people responding to these basic, just buy this shit, ads?
Right.
In one market, and in another market, they're responding like crazy.
Right.
And you start thinking, well, it's because of need. It's because where they're at. You start getting into the head of the prospect or the mass of prospects and realizing, yeah, there may be 15 different reasons why the mass is buying, but there may be one reason that really stands out, and that's the one that maybe you're at your focus on, and then bring the others in. That's where bullets come from. Bullets are kind of the main reason that bullets work so well in advertising, because it takes all those ideas that weren't quite big enough to go into the headline or the subhead or the main sales thing, but you wanted to get them in anyway. And it kind of rounds out everything. It takes in every possible objection and reason why and things, and leaves the prospect with no out, no easy way to say, no, I'm not going to buy because this. Well, no, that's not true. Actually, they covered that. And I'm not going to buy because it's too expensive. I'm too old for this. It won't work where I'm going, or it doesn't solve my problem. You just knock all of those off. But you can't do that without understanding the prospect on a visceral level, and that involves understanding how the brain works. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it's great. It's great.
It was quite a rant, wasn't it?
It was. But, you know, God, I had a really good point a second ago, and then you got me fascinated with that.
Gotta start taking notes.
I know. But, you know, I'd like to bring it back to, I think, you know, Maslow's hierarchy comes into this to a pretty strong degree, because I'm looking at it as you're describing the different levels of the brain.
I used to have a copy up on the wall. In fact, I do over on my across the room. I do have Maslow's. I haven't looked at it in a couple of years, but I looked at it all the time. So go ahead.
Yeah, so there's a link to it. And so really it's the bottom two you talked about, you know, physiological needs, breathing, food, water, sex, sleep, homeostasis, excretion, right? And safety doesn't come in really until number two, right? Security of body, employment, resources, morality, the family, health, property. I mean, a shelter is a basic, very basic need. But and then everything above that, which is you know, most of the pyramid, which we kind of designed on our own. It wasn't his structure, but you said friendship, family, sexual intimacy, then esteem, which, as we know, I think you play to that a lot in your writing, and then self-actual.
Most people lead lives of quiet desperation, as Thoreau so eloquently noted. Mm-hmm. They don't feel respected. They don't feel their lives are going anywhere. They feel like they've been ignored, overlooked, that they are unfairly left behind. They aren't in there. And one of the best ways to think about it for me was there's a party going on and they weren't invited.
Great. So I think about it. I just jumped into this new niche, this, you know, survival preparedness, fascinating niche. So outside
preppers?
Of
does it include preppers?
Preppers. Yeah. Yeah.
Doomsday
preppers. I tell you what, it's fascinating because it's a broader niche than most people probably realize already. For instance, there's a great piece in the New York Times about this sort of prepper guru in New York City. And a big movement happened after Hurricane Sandy. Began to develop after 9/11, and then after Sandy, especially because people are looking around and they're going, "All right, man, I am really fucking defenseless on this island right here. I mean, you know, there's how do I even get off this thing if with public
if the Holland Tunnel is flooded?
That's right. Yeah. That's right. There's you know, so everybody at least wants to have what they call a bug out bag." Which is your essentials for living for a couple days on the run, right? And so he goes and he teaches these classes, and it's fascinating. If I look at this chart and I think about what I understand in my sort of new research about this market, I'd say most of it is those bottom two columns, physiological and safety. But if you look at doomsday preppers, then you have to start getting into this other more intelligent ideas about, you know, when is the world going to end? What's going to do us in? Is it weather patterns? Is it nuclear destruction? Is it electromagnetic warfare? You know, who's going to get us, and what's that going to look like? And that's when you start to break down the different sort of sub niches of it, right?
That's right.
So,
and actually, when you get into the prepper mindset, and I've spent a lot of time with survivalists through my work with self-defense industry, so a lot of these guys, and you can put them down, but a lot of these guys are sensible about it. The vast majority, however, are not. They have a sense that if they have enough guns and food and water stored up and they have a little bit of a castle going, they're going to survive. And part of the reason they want to do that is so they can laugh at their liberal neighbors across the street as they die and knock on their door begging for water, and they get to say no.
Yeah,
have these elaborate visions in their head.
Yeah,
that often are nonsense.
A big part of it is King of the Hill, right?
King of the Hill. That's right.
And so, if you're sitting down
you're gonna regret ever letting your kid come on my lawn because I'm I'm not going to give you any of my canned beans when the shit hits the fan.
Yeah, and they I'm sure they walk around with these goggles 24 hours a day just looking at everybody going, "You poor stupid suckers, you have no idea what this is when this shit goes down, man."
They may be right,
And they may be right. So when you approach this market, where would you start? Do you have to start at the very basic needs going, okay, this is the instinct they're following, which is the truer, reasoning, I guess, is what I'm asking you. Is it the safety and the physiological thing that everybody will always have? Or it must have been developed somewhere more up in esteem and that kind of place. So
it gets back to fear and greed. Mm-hmm. And that actually is, if you look at Maslow's hierarchy and you kind of squint, it kind of comes down to fear and greed, a big chunk of it. Mm-hmm. Fear includes loss of the primary sustainability stuff, loss of access to water, food, and shelter. Greed is you want to make sure that you're safe, and you might be willing to sacrifice other people so that you're safe and things. But a lot of this has, from what I found in my research, I did not know this coming out, and I didn't even suspect it. But you start interviewing these guys, and you have to interview them with critical thinking. You got to really bring your critical thinking chops. You don't challenge them as they're talking, but let them talk it out, and then think about what is he really saying. What is the hypertext of what he's actually saying? Mm-hmm. And you can start to don't come with predetermined ideas like, oh, he's got to be a psycho, first of all. He's got to be a nutball. You know, no, don't back off of that. Why does all this come? And this gets down to why CSI shows are so great on TV, you know, the crime scene investigation units. You know, the beat cop is going to say, yeah, the guy got pissed off and off the guy, you know, because he disrespected him or something. But you can't stop at that. If you're a detective, you have to, quote unquote, solve this case. You have to get into the psychological aspects, what's going on here. And that, and in the shows, of course, that often uncovers this other thing going on, either a vast conspiracy by somebody or some other thing that's happening. This guy got caught in the crossfire and things like that. It's the same with any market. And these guys are actually more, the preppers are more interesting because they are playing out. A lot of these guys have ties with conspiracy theorists. Now, some conspiracies actually are conspiracies. It's like you're not necessarily paranoid if you think people are coming after you.
Yeah,
you know?
The great Pink Floyd line, right?
Exhibit,
yeah.
What, pardon me?
The great Pink Floyd line, just because you're paranoid doesn't mean they're not after you. Yeah.
Not really after you, yeah. So, but if you think people are, even if people really are like 7 days of the Condor or whatever, if people are after you and you discover these things, you're going to start exhibiting the same thinking patterns and behavior as somebody who has imaginary aliens after them. So you start seeing, well, what's the common thread here and what's real, what's not, and why are some people believing that some things are real when you think it's nonsense? You know, the government's not going to come and black helicopters. You know, they talk about the black helicopter crowd. There's been a lot of people thinking that, you know, secret UN forces are building up to take away their guns and their freedoms and whatever.
Obama's private army, yeah.
Yeah, so, you know, there may well be a 1984 version of reality just over the horizon where we are in perpetual war, where we are – you know, controlled by the man in ways that leave us without, you know, without the ability to think freely or read what we want, where censorship rules. There's a lot of countries where that's the case right now. That's where they talk about the beacon on the hill, you know, America. For all its faults, for me, I prefer being here because I like freedom of thought. That's huge for me. I hate censorship. And, you know, we've got a good chance of making it work here. At least it's been winning so far. A lot of flaws going on, but why is this a constant battle? Why does Catcher in the Rye get banned? Why does Mark Twain get banned in some schools? What is freaking people out? And if you can narrow it down to, rather than, you know, these people, what are they freaked out about, and what do they want that they're not getting right now in life? So if those are the main things you learn, what's the greed and the fear of value here? What are they afraid of? What do they want that they're not getting? And then you start allowing for or the various things. They have emotional needs, they have physical needs, they have intellectual needs, they have spiritual needs. And how are these things being met or not met as you're interviewing them and listening to them? And only because I've been in this market before, I happen to know that a lot of this has to do with the feelings of lack of respect. So that's like an intellectual thing. Mm-hmm. These people are not physiologically harmed. They're not, their health is not harmed, though they fear for their health. They don't drink tap water because of the fluoride in it sometimes. I'm conflating a lot of, you know, the preppers aren't necessarily conspiracy freaks, but there is a lot of that in there. So you start thinking, well, physiologically, that ain't really it. It's more of an intellectual, emotional thing going on. And there may be some spirituality into it when you're getting into people who think that the world's going to change because of a second coming or an upheaval. Everything from the Mayan calendar freak out last year to the second coming of Christ to all of these things. These things play on fears that we all have. Yeah, I didn't want to get into religion. I don't necessarily want to offend anybody, but basically those fears can be brought down to a basic idea that the world ain't treating me right, and goddamn it, you fuckers are going to pay when, you know, the great spaghetti monster finally comes to Earth and teaches everybody the final lesson or whatever. It's as common. It's been through history. It was back before science was around to kind of say, well, no, you're the center of the human body is not in the heart. It's actually in the brain, you know, and you know, your blood's red because it's carrying oxygen, and it's blue going the other way because it's deprived of oxygen or whatever. And you start to answer these questions. And sometimes that brings us to a better understanding of what's going on, making us less open to wild fears, to unsubstantiated fears, but it can open up all kinds of other fears. The more we know about science, the more we know that if I sneeze, well, that may be a cold, or it may be the what's that flu, that the Asian flu, you know, mm-hmm. where no antibiotics work, you know, and, mm-hmm. you know, or, you know, oh my God, I took antibiotics last year for an infection, you know, because the cat bit me. Does that mean if I catch it, the flu again this year, the antibiotics won't work and all that? And these are real things, but they're abstract thoughts. It's not really happening. So where does that come from? So that's a long way around the block to try to address what you're talking about. But for me, that's the most interesting part of this gig as a freelance writer. I got to dive into new markets. Yeah. I dealt with people who were investors. And this led, by the way, this is a slight aside, but when day trading came about, and I'm not sure if I mentioned this to you before or not, Kevin, but a number of writers I know, like Jimmy, was doing something on day traders. And he knew, he had worked in the financial part of the marketing world for people who were investing long term, or people who, you know, wanted to invest in mutual funds, things like that. But he never dealt with day traders, and he, and some other guys I know have done this, and they didn't understand how day traders are different than the what we call the average investor, the long term investor, the guy who just wants a good investment, he wants to sit on what we used to call widow and orphans funds. But it has a little bit of, so maybe his risk is a little higher. But how did day traders get into this? Mm-hmm. And I realized it right away, only because I dealt with similar types of humans in other kinds of situations. And a day trader is a gambler. Mm-hmm. A day trader has more in common with a cocaine user or a gambling addict, mm-hmm. because they are going for that light up of the part of the limbic system where, you know, there's chemical dumps and it's just, oh, I won and oh, I lost and both of it, and they're just on junk and they're doing stuff really fast. Once these guys started approaching them rather from, oh, it's just a sensible investor looking for a long-term score who got into day trading because they think they're going to make a win, that's not the right approach, because money doesn't matter to most day traders, to the guys who are willing to buy a product to get more info on being a better day trader, doing all this stuff. That's not what they want. They want the win, but the money matters not a whit. So they will be doing this after they become multi-gazillionaires, and they'll do it if they're broke and they got to sell the Chevy out front to be able to play tomorrow. Right. Does that make sense?
Yeah, totally. So don't base your pitch to those guys on the functionality of your new system and how convenient it is.
It's
all ego. It's all instinct. It's all the.
But you can't say that. You can't have headlines. Hey, are you a whacked out ego? Afraid of your own shadow, gambling addict, and day trading? I've got news for you. You know.
So, no, you got to. You got to say something like, "Are you missing out? Are you?" Yeah.
The fear of other day traders are getting the greedy stuff that you wish you had, and you're missing out because you're not in on with the cool kids getting this daily email that whatever.
Right.
You know?
Exactly right.
It all gets back to junior high, too. We're in the jungle. That's the two realizations that we are more or less in our own jungle. And if you want to get a good idea of how humans really relate, go to the San Diego Zoo as a good one, or someplace that has an ape exhibit. Watch the apes. I've taken people there. I go, just watch. Mm. And they'll watch for long. They'll go, eventually they'll go, oh God, that's Bob, isn't it? You know, it's Bob in the office, is the alpha silver-backed ape doing his thing. And it's just you start to, and it's not because they look like it, it's because they're acting like it.
No, it's so true. You know, I whenever I go to see the gorillas when we go, I stand there and I watch with my kids, and I go, that is us on Saturday morning. All they want to do is wrestle in the bed, right? They, Dad, can we wrestle? Can we wrestle? And whatever that is for them, it makes them feel safe, or they get to challenge themselves, or it's the same thing the gorillas are doing. You'll see the little gorilla come over to the silverback and try to jump on him, and he just kind of tosses him off, and you know, he comes back for more, and I go, wow, it's on that level. My son's 9, my daughter's 6, and I think about what does my son, what's he concerned about on the playground? Like, and you're right. I mean, that's really where it all comes down to. And he cares about, you know, How did he do in football that day? Who scored more points? What was fair? What wasn't fair? What kids? And my daughter's more concerned with, what girls are friends right now? Who's not friends anymore already at this age? And it really comes down to those very basic instinctual feelings of, like you said, fear and greed, love and acceptance, inside, outside. Where do you stand at any given time?
This is where we kind of failed kids. This is another talk, but because you brought it up, I just got to throw this in there. I believe my generation, the boomers, were the first ones with the luxury to be able to pay more attention to our peer group than we did to the adults around us. Mm-hmm. We broke away from the adults in this massive rebellion we had because we thought they were playing it too safe and they were doing things wrong and we knew better and stuff. And it's somehow that stuck. So that a lot of young kids are growing up and they're still paying more attention to their peer group and what they think about stuff than the wealth of information and examples of how to act are out there. And it will hurt you. The luckiest people, you and I are, we're 20, 30 years apart. I know a lot of guys like you who are younger, but even when I was coming up, I always hung with older guys. And mm-hmm. younger guys, age was not a matter of whether it was part of my peer group or not. That was totally irrelevant. Halbert was 12 years older than me. Stan was 13 years younger, or is. And we all got along great because age wasn't the matter. It was what are you bringing to the table? Yeah. When in my group, and I remember growing up, suddenly it was like adults. We didn't want anything to do with adults. And we no longer respected the authority of adults. And that's where it broke down. And we started paying attention and looking for hints on how to act to our peer group. Big mistake, because the peer group, even the guy you think is the most together hip guy in high school, is still – he's in high school. He doesn't have his act together. He doesn't know what's going on. He hasn't had a job. He hasn't been out in life. He doesn't know. So you start modeling yourself. You start thinking, well, he's got it together and we'll do this. And your world just kind of collapses in on itself. And you wind up married at 23 with no idea what you're going to do or what the real world is about and things like that. So it's a big problem. And you talk about the kids wrestling and stuff. And you're absolutely right. That covers, you're wrestling and stuff, but you're not hurting them. You're not trying to show them self-defense techniques. They're able to test their strength limits. They're a little stronger than they were a month ago when they wrestled with you. They're able to get your arm down on the pillow. And they're able to fall off the bed by accident and they didn't cry. I remember the first time I didn't cry. I was playing pickle in a field, going between two bases playing baseball. I slid in. I hadn't noticed this glass and a glass slid open my thumb. I still have the scar here. And I remember we could see bone and there was blood. And my cousin Donald, who's a year younger than me, he goes, "Hey, you didn't cry." I said, "Yeah, how cool is that?" It's like blood oozing off. And I still remember that. I didn't cry, And what is going on there? This is part of the socialization process, the process of moving from one stage of complete a dependent childhood to a more independent part of childhood, which is always moving towards total independence, which often never happens with kids. The differentiation between who you are and what you represent and who they are, and all of these things are going on. And just looking at it in a shallow way, you can enjoy it and it's great. But you can also look at it in a deeper way and it won't affect the joy of it at all. It will merely open up. It might even increase the joy when you understand how they're testing themselves, how they're measuring themselves in incremental ways. It's kind of like, I don't know if you've got that in your house where you're measuring their height on the wall.
Sure, yeah.
That's often one of the more treasured parts of people's houses when they sell them, is those penciled lines of how, Susie grew and Tommy grew and there'll be the names next to the kids. And, what is that? That's the Maslow thing going on. These kids, as they grow, they're testing their own boundaries, their own ability to get what they need rather than totally rely on you. And all of these things are going on. And it's a wonderful process. And when you're more aware of it, you just enjoy it more. And then you can also turn that into – and just to finalize the thing of why this doesn't make you cynical by knowing more about what's going on. I am not some master persuader. I can't take somebody who doesn't want what I'm selling and make them want it. There's no magical way to do that. You can hypnotize people. NLP has a lot of claims that it isn't necessarily able to back up. Doing triggers and anchors and all this stuff.
Right.
But if you want it, and you're resisting for whatever reason, the better I am as a salesman, I can take care of those objections you have in a written ad or in a video sales letter. And I can make it so it makes sense to you intellectually. It feels good to make the buy. You're a little scared that you don't want it to get away from you, so you want to buy it now. And I'm doing you a favor by making you buy because this really is going to change your life. And that comes from me being able to deal from an ethical standpoint of I have a good product. So damn it, I'm going to do whatever I need to do to get you that because I know you're even no matter how much you know, you realize and you agree with me that this is going to help you and change your life. Still part of you is going to slack off and you're not going to do it. Mm-hmm. So I'm going to, you know what? You got till Friday. I'm sorry, guy. I don't have time to screw around with this. If you don't get it by Friday, it's gone. I'm going to give it to the guy below you on the list. I'm going to give it to your neighbor, you know, and he will forever be able to gloat about how you passed up an opportunity that changed that he was then able to take over and get on his life. So the guy says, oh, no, you're not giving it to Bob, my neighbor. Okay, I'll take it, damn it. And of course, you got a huge guarantee. If you're not happy, you send it back, you get all your money back. What is the big deal? Well, the big deal is I got taken, you know, somebody stole my marbles in the third grade and I'm still carrying around that baggie. He doesn't realize that, but if you realize it, then you're able to get in there and be able to help him get through that emotional blockage or the physiological blockage. You know, it's just, I don't feel good when I buy stuff, you know. I've only got so much money. When it's gone, it'll never be replaced. Yeah, well, money's a fungible part of life. It's not, you know, that goes back to the Freudian thing of kids wanting to play with their poop, you know. It's just people have weird attitudes about money and sex and respect and things. And you can either be, what most people do is go, yeah, aren't people weird? But salesmen get to go, well, they're weird because they're probably carrying around some baggage about, and maybe they aren't getting respected. And this is a way for you to get some respect, publish your own book, you know, if you're doing that kind of thing. This is a way for you to get a better job, get more money. Your wife will respect you more. And look at the things you can do. And this is why having more money and doing it, blah, blah, blah. All this stuff starts to fit in together of why this is going. And again, this all has to start with an ethical product and being able to just stand up and live with yourself after you've said, this really will do this. So,
great. Awesome. Okay.
Yeah, well, I think that's probably enough.
We've exhausted that and really only just begun in some other ways. But it's a fascinating topic. So
just one last thing. When you go online, you Google human brain, you're going to get there's a lot of sites there like the Mayo Clinic and Harvard medical sites that are a little too intellectual, that are a little too academic about this. There are other sites. And the one I used was the humanbrainproject.org. I think this is funded by the government. So the humanbrainproject.org. And that is more of a layman's access. So that'll say, you know, this is why the brain does this. It actually uses the word the reptile brain, things like that, whereas the other sites don't do that because that's not what scientists like to hear. You know, they don't like to talk that way. So right. So don't just hop on the first site when you're looking at the brain. And like I say, if you see an article in Salon or if there's anything from Psychology Today or anything that speaks to the layman, gobble that stuff up because that's taking scientific gobbledygook and bringing it down into everyday language where you can start to understand what's going on. We're complex creatures, but we are not undecipherable. We are very much – we can understand what's going on to a level where we can use that knowledge to be better salesmen, better people, better husbands, better everything. Mm. Okay, now I'm done.
Awesome. Pretty bow you put on it there, John.
A pretty bow.
Thanks, buddy. Great show, and we'll be back at it very soon. Thanks, everybody, for listening.
Bye-bye.